In 1967, we awoke to the knowledge of the village. Now, 50 years on, we invite you, good citizens, to join us in celebrating the timeless topics, eloquent prose, and striking visuals of the iconic programme, The Prisoner.
Welcome to the Eternal Village Cast, a program of conversations with those who created, those who've contributed to the canon, and those who cherish the brilliant and influential program, The Prisoner.
Your attention, please. The Entertainment Committee is pleased to present numbers 48 and 100. Good people, please welcome Sophia and Michael. Do not forsake me, oh my darling.
So for those of you who were with us in Seattle last September, in the melee and the fun that encompassed that autumn night, we were very blessed to have number 48, number 100 with us, otherwise known in the real world as Sophia and Michael, because not only did they perform songs in this massive and beautiful compendium about the episodes of The Prisoner, they actually performed one of the last songs they created to conclude that collection. Am I correct, you two, that you have now put all 17 into the digital universe? That is kind of a completed process right now.
Yes. As far as we're concerned, it's a complete whole. It's 17 songs and a couple covers here and there. But yeah, it took us a really long time, and it shouldn't have. But, you know, life gets in the way and other projects get in the way. But it's a really important band to me. It was my main songwriting project for, I don't know, almost 10 years. So it's very small output for 10 years, but it's 17 songs. I'm really proud of them all. And they're all inspired by episodes of The Prisoner. So, you know, I would watch The Prisoner and think about my feelings and then take in my own life. And, you know, sometimes using like a little snippet of dialogue here and there, sometimes not. But creating new work inspired by it. So, all the 17, they're out, they're on Bandcamp, they're on Spotify, you can find them. There's no physical thing of all of them, but it's out in the digital world.
Yeah, we took too long to release it physically because physical media kind of disappeared during the time when we were working on the project. So,
I find, well, first of all, I would say never criticize yourself for the length of time. It's the quality, because I have a lot of music that I bought in the 70s that came out very quickly, and there was a lot of it. It wasn't that great a quality. So 17 beautiful and thoughtful and creative songs, regardless of how long, we appreciate it. So there is, it seems like, the constant ebb and flow. You know, for a while we had music on various media. And then, and we'll blame Napster, suddenly it became just a digital battleground, and everything became something that was electronic. But it seems like in the last couple of years, there's all these articles about cassettes are coming back. And every concert I go to, it seems like the new thing is that the artist is selling their material on vinyl. Do you guys think that there's any chance that we, dear fans, could maybe one day see a collection of all the songs, maybe on something as simple as a thumb drive with some art, or is that just not a priority for where your creative endeavors are going?
Well, probably not a thumb drive, because I don't really see the difference much between that and just downloads. But I would love to do vinyl. It would just take having pre-orders, and I haven't put the effort into getting enough pre-orders to do a vinyl, because you know, I'd want to have them pre-sold, basically. I don't want to be sitting. I've sat with hundreds, thousands of CDs for various bands that didn't last long enough to tour and sell them, that I'm not going to make that mistake in life again.
No.
Yeah, we talked for a long time about doing a vinyl box set, and I think that would be an amazing project to do. It just,
It would be several records long.
It's financially challenging. We've also talked about doing various versions of some of the, like re-recording some of the early songs in a different way that's more matching with the later songs. So we have like a few takes on some of the ideas because we've, you know, we've evolved in our...
Yeah, like the later songs are very different. You know, we started off very minimalist, like we wanted just drums and just bass and just voice. Mm-hmm. And then as time went on, we got a little trapped in that, I think. And then we were like, well, let's add like a viola to this one because we have a friend come over and play. Then it just got super electronic towards the end. While still having that minimalist vibe, like it was different suddenly. But so yeah, they're not, like I think there is a cohesive, like, you kind of listen to it, it's cohesive, but.
Yeah, so maybe someday we'll release a physical, but it's not in the cards immediately.
Yeah,
got it. Yeah, it's a shame that the imprinting or the creation of those kind of media isn't as simple nowadays as it is to do, for lack of a better word, vanity press. You know, you can make a book and actually run a copy per copy, but it's not that way with recorded media. It's a bigger challenge.
Yeah, there's minimums to fulfill for sure.
Yeah.
We could do CD. We could do short run CDs, but the packaging isn't that good then. And so we kind of only want to do something if it's going to be really
special.
Yeah, nice, like a really nice thing.
It really does. And I would say that would go along with the quality of the songs you created for us. Now, as you mentioned, that across that time span and across that collection, your own artistic style evolved. Is there any thought of taking the same passion and applying that to something else, another book, another show, another movie, another character? Or was that a one-time approach to taking, and I'm going to use a terrible term, but songifying or to create music around some other art form? Is that another possibility for you guys?
I think that's something we do a lot because, you know, as artists, we take in culture and we take in other people's art and kind of spit it back out through our own lens. Mm-hmm. And so I think like with songs, we've done projects, like different projects where we've done songs about what was sold in the back of comic books in the 70s, like Sea Monkeys and X-Ray Specs. Like we had a whole project for that a few years ago. And another band did a project where we looked at our friends' art and wrote songs about what was going on in their visual pieces. So it's definitely something we do where we take, you know, somebody else's thing and we put it through our own, we chew it up and spit it back out in our own way, with permission usually. Or it's so abstract that like whatever, you know. And so our main focus, I mean, we still want to do music and I would love to start another band. And like my output, I think, where it's inspired by Patrick McGoohan's character so much. And I think that will always come through in the music, even if it isn't downright inspired by a specific plot or a specific moment. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, in my music is paranoid and angry and individualistic and, you know, it has those elements always. So that'll go forward. But our focus more is on film these days.
Yeah, when we started the band, the first couple of years, we thought we would breeze through these 17 songs. And so we had discussions right at the beginning. We're like, what are we going to do when this is over? Do we have to move on to the Avengers or some other...
We get asked that all the time. Yeah, we're doing the Avengers next. Like, there's hundreds of episodes.
Too many episodes. Yeah.
Maybe just the Diana Rigg ones, and even those, there's like
too many.
100.
No, there's yeah, not
there's
quite
so many.
No, so we did talk about this idea, and I think, you know, if we found inspiration, something we'd do it, but we don't want to do it just to do it. You know, The Prisoner is a special thing to us. But like Sophia said, we really enjoy doing projects with specific scopes. It helps. If you sit down to write a song, it's a lot easier if you sort of have an idea like, okay, I want to kind of work within this realm or within this topic. Or, you know, lately we've been doing a lot of the only songwriting we've really been doing is for our films. And so a lot of that is like, okay, well, we need a song about this specific topic that fits in this scene in the film.
In the style. We've been working on a soundtrack to our fourth film right now. So I'm like, that's like been the only songwriting I've done in like a year, probably. Like, and here's like a random song about Hollywood, and here's a song about whatever. So it's been funny, but it's a skill. But also, you know, sometimes it's better or it's different to just sit down and try to like find those creative.
Sure, sure.
That's a lot harder.
I can only imagine. It's like they say the scariest thing to any creative person is a blank sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. You can go anywhere with that. So tell us, you touched on it. Tell us about your latest film project, please.
Yeah, so it's called Clickbait, and mm-hmm. we shot it in December, and we are just almost done with editing it now and going to be submitting it to festivals and doing all that business very soon. But it's about two college-age girls who are caught up in internet fame and making videos for the for a website and kind of pursuing that rather than anything else.
Yeah, and it's sort of, I mean, we wanted to make like a kind of a satire about the impositions of fame culture on young people. So it's kind of like, you know, it's really there's a lot of art or the creative work or other things being made about how like millennials are vapid or like are not, don't, you know, don't really have depth of character or depth of creativity or aesthetics. And so we wanted to make something that kind of was about how they're being shortchanged by the world.
It's sympathetic to them. It's not like these damn kids. Mm-hmm. Right. Internet. It's sympathetic to like, what are the pressures being put on them by having to put themselves out there and create this content.
Right. So it's sort of a satire. It has a lot of thriller and horror elements, which is kind of our normal.
It got very comedic.
it's a dark comedy. At this point. Yeah.
Okay. Because yes. I was going to say, because it's true, the other films do have a very particular, or align to a very particular genre, but what you seem to be describing sounds like, again, you're, as artists, you're stretching yourself. You're taking those core skills, but you're going to pull them into a way that maybe finds a different audience, finds a bigger audience.
Yeah, absolutely. This is definitely, each of our three films so far, we kind of picked a genre that we love and tried mm-hmm. to do some justice to it and tried to update it and make it more modern while still, you know, keeping those elements. But yeah, this is definitely going to be our most mainstream movie to date. But I leaked in enough weirdness to it, I think, that I still enjoy it. But it's definitely more typical fare from us. But
we started out thinking it would be kind of like a teen satire, like a Heathers kind of thing with a little more horror in it. And as it evolved, it just got weirder and weirder, which is what always happens to us. We add more inside jokes and more layers of circular humor and things. So it's still pretty strange, but it's a pretty mainstream project.
Okay. Now, speaking of mainstream, you made the leap of faith and you moved all the way from the great town of Boston to the big metropolis of Los Angeles. And I know from previous conversations, and you've mentioned that a lot of the film work you did in New England was, they were passion projects. They were people you knew who were very talented, but they were doing this on their spare time. They were doing this in, you know, extra hours, things like that. Mm-hmm. Working in Los Angeles, do you find that your ability to be able to produce is faster because of the resources, or has it become more cumbersome because there's just too much demand?
It's a double-edged sword, I think, because, you know, it took us probably a year to settle in and to meet enough people to actually, because you need people to make films. It's very hard to make films by yourself in your living room, unlike music. So I just leapt into working on films right away, and I met a lot of great crew and brought them into our project when we were ready to shoot. So everybody that worked on our film, I worked with in LA on other films. And so in that way, it's been really great because this is world-class crew. They're amazing and all just really great. They all come with amazing gear and experience and were super creative, and this is what they do all the time. So that's been really amazing. And then, of course, you know, the actors and everything else, like, we had a very good time casting this film and finding exactly what we wanted. You can ask for anything here. You can ask for a juggler who, you know, is Siberian. Like, I don't know. You can ask for whatever, and somebody is here doing it. So,
yeah. There's definitely a very, very big pool of people who are really dedicated to doing professional work, and that was great. I mean, for our lead role, I think we looked at like 700, you know, applications or something, and slowly whittled it down through a few stages of auditions and things to really find, you know, the exact right person for the role. And we definitely didn't have access to a pool like that in Boston. It was, you know, it was more like, all right, who's willing to show up and do the thing? And that's good enough. You know,
in Boston, the cool thing is like, we encouraged friends of ours who were doing art in other fields to act in film, because there weren't a lot of film actors that we had access to.
Right.
So we would ask like our friends that were burlesque artists, or we'd ask our friends that were poets or musicians, and we would get them to act in the films. And that has its own special qualities for sure. And it worked out really well for us while we were there. But there is something else to be had with somebody who has studied it for a long time, studied acting, and wants to pursue it as their main pursuit. That's really helpful for moving fast.
And going back to your point, Sophia, about double-edged sword, is it also then from the creative side almost overwhelming to say, oh my God, I have to look at 700 potential characters, people, versus, as you say, you had three people in Boston who maybe were available. Does it become more, literally, even though there's more resources, to become more stressful as a process?
It becomes more of a shallow process, I think, because you have to eliminate so quickly. So it kind of feels bad to just be like looking at hundreds of photos and be like, nope. And then like picking the 50 that you want to see a video audition from. It's like a very weird feeling process.
Yeah.
That first culling, you know, because you can't talk to 700 people. It's impossible.
No.
So, like, immediately you just have to eliminate people. And it's very arbitrary, the reasons why, like, you scan past a photo.
But I think also, I mean, I think this is true at every single level and every single creative endeavor. We did draw from our own friends and community and people. So, you know, for our lead role, we didn't have a person in our friend pool who was going to be able to do that. But for a lot of the other smaller roles, we thought, oh, okay, we know this person who'd be perfect for that. So we definitely fill it in with what I would say are kind of safe people, because they're predictable. You know, you're friends with them, you work with them, they're going to show up, they're going to do the thing, they're going to cooperate, whatever. And we didn't have any real issues, but you just never know with somebody that you're, you know, that you're casting off the web or something like that. You know,
it's absolutely true. Your own repertory players, for however much they've been large or small parts of it, like you say, it's a known element. When you have somebody, even their reputation may not be the way they behave once they're there on set. Do you find that, now both of you have not only the creative side, but you have the technical side. Did you find that you discovered things from the people there in Los Angeles who have been making this their job every day? Have you learned new things and new, as they say, tricks of the trade?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're always learning because we're both self-taught, and we're both just highly, like, aggressive towards learning everything we need to know about how to do our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've been working camera department for 2 years in various jobs, and I learn something new every time. I'm like, you know, even just like little things like these rubber bands, you know, like these specific rubber bands. Like, now I always have them with me, like stuff like that, where it's like you only get it from being on set for long hours.
I mean, I think it's also true that, so like, both of us have worked camera on other people's projects, for example, and sound on other people's projects. And when we were doing that in Boston, the projects were kind of limited to a certain scope and limited to a certain kind of scale and professionalism, or professional goals, I would say, with them. And as soon as we got here, especially Sophia has been involved in a lot of, you know, growing size productions, and has, you're basically working on, you know, pretty much more, much higher budget stuff than we've ever worked on before. So, you know, you're basically just ramped right up to professional standards and, you know, professional levels. And we're working with people who have technical knowledge and expectations that are much higher level. So we ourselves have to get up you know, we're expected to be at the same level as all those people.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, like the night before, if I know I'm working with a new piece of gear the night before I read the manual. It's just so I know I'm not going to be a total idiot on set the next day.
Well, forgive me for making this gross generalization, but there again proves what a brilliant woman you are, because any other guy would show up and go, yeah, sure, I read the whole thing. It's got a button, right?
Yeah. I worked with those guys, yeah.
Yes, you have. I work with them every day.
Very quickly.
Yep. I call them engineers, but I work with them every day. So now you just mentioned the idea of goals changing. Not only has the economy of it and the scope of it, but the goals. And the beautiful films that you created when you're in Boston, they certainly had a goal to, I'm assuming, be able to entertain the world, be able to inspire people with that. Now, do you find that in Los Angeles, there's other driving factors like going to more festivals, finding a distributor? Has the overall goal for you two changed in a bigger fishbowl?
I mean, I think it's the same goal, except for now we've taken the leap where it has to work. Like in Boston, we still had some normal jobs and things, and now here we're totally freelance. Yeah. So, you know, it's the same goals of going to festivals and making sure people see it and getting our ideas out there. But it's also ramping it up with each project, trying to get more investors, trying to get more access to production companies that want to fund our next film, give us money for the next thing. So like the goal is to make a career out of it.
Yeah.
And we've grown every time. I mean, with each film, the first one we sort of were like, well, let's just make a thing and see if anybody wants to look at it. And then we're like, oh, we got distribution, you know, we were shocked that, you know, anything happened with it. And so, you know, after that, we're like, okay, well, let's do better this time. And then the third one, you know, let's do better this time. And I think this one, we did make a concerted effort. It's not a, you know, $100 million blockbuster, but we did make a concerted effort to say, okay, we have to think of our career growth in this as well, because it is becoming more and more important to us. So we have to make something that's a little more mainstream, that's, you know, without abandoning our creative interests and our creative goals. But yeah, I think, you know, every project, it's like we want to get into better festivals, we want to get better distribution, we want to get a better sales agent. And so far, we've been able to always, you know, climb the mountain. And I'm hoping this time we find ourselves, you know, up at a higher elevation than we were before. And that's, mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, I think that's, as long as we see that kind of growth, I'm happy. You know, as long as we see that we're always moving up, that's great.
Yeah.
Now, when looking back at that, of course, it is, your metaphor of the mountain is correct. People look at the hierarchy you're making, and new people want to get on board because you're climbing. Do you find in Los Angeles that you have a different caliber of people that can help you get to those new levels? I'm assuming the sense of, as you said, a sales agent. And then in direct relation to that, in the world we're living in today, with all of the different streaming platforms that are just starving for content, has the ability for you to find outlets gotten easier? Or is there simply just so many more fish in the sea right now to have a place for your product to go?
Well, it definitely, we have access to people who are business-minded here. There was no industry in Boston. So here there are actually people who are like, we make movies for a living. Mm-hmm. We have companies that make, you know, make profits or survive whatever on the sales of these movies. So they have the pipelines and the systems in place for actually, you know, doing these over and over again. And that's really what you need, is you need that pipeline in place. In terms of platforms, it's very, very easy for us to get our film on just about any, well, not exactly every platform, but most of the VOD platforms and those kinds of things. The problem is that it's very easy for everyone to do that. And so there's so much content that actually getting people to watch something and make money, you know, to make money on that way requires marketing and other kinds of things that are you know, built into these pipelines and these systems by that the companies who are in the business of making profits on the films. Mm-hmm. They have those systems in place. And so we need that support. We don't have that personally. I wish we did, but So you know, we need to start working with those kinds of people, and they're available to us to, you know, to an extent. I mean, they need content. They need films to be made in order to be able to sell them, right? So people go to film markets. The sales agents, if they don't have films, they're not going to have much work to do. So, you know, we're just as important to them as they are to us in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It's a symbiotic relationship. It really is. Because the person selling is not making the product if they don't have something, you're right. And again, at a certain point, if we have so many streaming services, but case in point, if you look across, let's say, the major three, which is Hulu, Netflix, and Amazon, for lack of, you know, and it gets to be the point where I think what they used to try to say was we have unique content. And I oftentimes, when scanning, because as odd as it is, you know, there's still nothing to see. And you find that the same movies and the same TV shows are now ubiquitous. And I wonder, that then means, well, why do I have to be a member of all three if everything's there? But you're right. It's a challenge, because how do you find something unless you're just scrolling through page after page of little image?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of reviews. I mean, luckily we work in horror, and horror has such a huge network of blogs and magazines and things, and people are still interested in it as a subgenre where they like really like, they want to know what's coming up. They want to see a trailer. They want to keep hearing about it. And there's like so many ways to get the word out in horror. Other genres, I have no idea. You know, it gets really hard unless it's somebody with a name, like some famous actors in it. Then, you know, then there's money and marketing behind it. Right. But yeah, like, I mean, I'll see it with like Netflix will have Star Trek and then it'll go away and then it's on Amazon for free. And it's like, they kind of surf it.
Yeah,
you know, where the show is, but it never quite goes away.
No, it doesn't. Really, no, in watching, especially your social media, Sophia, it's been really inspiring. There's a lot of times you've shared photos of people you've met in Los Angeles, whether they are groups that you've joined, women filmmakers, women of course. It's fantastic to see, because it's always your beaming smile and you look so engaged in those, but Have you met any people that were your idols? Have you met people that you never thought you'd get a chance to either interact with or work with? Has that happened in that small town of LA?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, one of the projects I'm involved with is the Women of Rock Oral History Project. And it's actually a project that I started working on while I was in Boston, because it was started by a friend who I was in a band with. And, so, you know, I helped her with interviewing a few women in Boston, like that had come through touring, like Lydia Lunch. And then once I moved to LA, it really opened up the project for her, because now she can come out here and stay with me. And then we get to meet like Danita Sparks from L7, who was my hero when I was 12, or the drummer Patty Schemmel from Hole, who was also my hero when I was 12, you know? So it's like, that's been, or Xene Cervenka, who's an ex, which is like super inspiring LA punk band. So that's been really insane. And Shirley Manson from Garbage, like that is like the biggest pop star to me, you know? Yeah. So that has definitely been weird. I find that I don't really change. It's really weird. Like I would think I would get more nervous, but it's just like, oh, this is a normal day. I'm just setting up a camera in front of Shirley Manson at a hotel, like in Beverly Hills, like whatever. But then afterwards it'll hit me like, oh, look, there's me with Shirley Manson. Okay, cool. So that's been really cool. But,
I think you start to learn that people are just normal people. Totally everybody's normal people, yeah. And everybody, you know, even with actors, I mean, we haven't done big projects where we're casting, you know, with more money yet, but it's, you'd be surprised at how high a level of actor is really just available if you have a good project and a little bit of money.
Right.
Because people want to work. They want to, you know, they want to make, the reason they got into acting is because they want to make films. And so,
especially at the indie level, if they are an actor who doesn't often get like a starring role where they're the first name on the bill, they'll do an indie film for less money. And because if it's something interesting and something where they get to be the lead, it's really exciting for them. So that's hopefully down the line a little bit. But
well, and in listening to interviews with others and podcasts, especially a lot of podcasts where there's a mix of, let's say, actors, comedians having a conversation, and please tell me your take on this. I've heard a lot of them say that because of the massive diversity of where people can be employed and so many platforms, that unlike in even 5-6 years ago, or heaven forbid, a decade ago, that there's more of a stratification than ever, which is you have one echelon of people who we all know because they're at the top of the poster and they're in every one of the big blockbusters. And they make still that massive Hollywood income. But what I've heard these other people say is that the rest of the folks are really getting down to the point where it's a sustenance income. And they really have to be more practical about taking jobs to keep their craft going, but also to keep themselves alive.
Yeah. And these projects, like if you look at people's IMDb's, you know, they're only doing 2 projects a year, if that, often. So it's like, that doesn't go that far, you know.
A lot of actors we know, especially in horror, a lot of the actors who are, you know, it's not necessarily household names, but kind of big in the genre, they're starting their own production companies and starting to make their own films because they, you know, they're sitting around and they're thinking, well, I'm not working 6 months of the year. I can write my own project and cast myself in it and do it, you know, do all this stuff. So you see a lot more of that kind of stuff, people realizing that they don't have to wait to make something happen, that they can just, you know, start their own thing and gather all their friends together to kind of get it moving. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it has become more of there's a lot more of the scrappy small productions that are kind of filling the field. And that at this point, because of technical advancements, can be pretty high quality. I mean, it's quite easy to get access to, you know, essentially the same camera that major blockbusters are being shot on. It's not very expensive at this point. And whereas, you know, 10 years ago, you could never afford that.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah. The if you will, the sort of homogenization of technology has made it more capable. But I would say, in both praise and defense of YouTube, you can give 1,000 people a camera that doesn't make them filmmakers. You can give 1,000,000 people a pen, it doesn't make them writers. Yeah. You still have to have, as YouTube demonstrate in all your projects, you have to have a creative core, because we've also seen movies that look great because somebody knew how to do something, but there's no story. There's no soul to it. And then what was the point?
Right. I mean, for us, I mean, part of what attracts us to like horror and sci-fi is that usually the movies are about something. Like there is subtext, or, you know, they point. And it's like, that's what draws me to films, is to have something to say, you know, about society, about whatever. So there's a lot of pretty movies with nothing to say. And then there's some really crappy looking movies that have a lot of great ideas. The balance is to find that middle ground, you know, of a nice camera and something to say.
Considering the idea of good story, if you will, let me play a little game with you. I want to ask you, right now, in the last few years, just the last few years, knowing the genres you love, you're passionate about, sci-fi and horror, in the last few years, besides your movies, what are films that you've really touched you, really impacted you? You would say to somebody sitting next to him on a train or a plane, hey, you got to watch this. What in the last couple of years have you loved?
We're looking at each other because I know we're both going to say Get Out. Because I think it's like one of the best movies of the last 20 years. I mean, I think it's amazing. The amount of like little details in there that all kind of loop back around to like the fundamental points of it is amazing. Yeah. And it was totally different than what I thought. I thought it was just going to be like a KKK movie. Like, you know, and it was so much more nuanced and important than that. Not that that's not important, but like important to what's going on right now in liberal culture. So I thought it was amazing. I think Mad Max Fury Road was an astonishing achievement of film, and the story is amazing, and like just the female characters that he put in there, like the old lady motorcycle gang, like to me, when those women showed up, I was like, that is my mom, that is like my people. When I'm 60, 70, 80, I want to be in that motorcycle gang, like, cause that's how strong I know women are. And so it's nice to see that reflected on the screen. So, what else do you think?
I mean, we've seen all, you know, it's a hard question to answer because there's such a range of different types of things that, you know, the bigger movies, the smaller movies. But in horror, I think there, or in genre film, I would say there tend to be a bunch of really interesting kind of small festival type movies that nobody really gets to see that I really liked. Like I really, I love this movie called Der Samurai that was, it was kind of a wolf man. This police officer is kind of fighting off this wolf man who's killing people in the town. And it's all this metaphor about him coming to terms with his sexuality and all this other stuff. And it's really, you know, thoughtful and well done. And, you know, I wasn't made for very much money. But it's a really interesting movie that we probably only got access to. I mean, it's out, but we probably only found out about it because it was at festivals.
Right.
I'm a big fan of this guy, Peter Strickland, who made The Duke of Burgundy, which is an amazing, it's so hard to explain. It's like the best meditation on the navigating love that I've ever seen. It's not really a horror film. It's kind of a strange, it's an homage to kind of 70s, almost like sexploitation films, but it's not really like that at all. And it's just a really beautiful, strange film set in this fantasy world where there are only women and they're all entomologists. And yeah, it's very weird. I don't really know.
But none of that is the point.
None of that is the point.
There's no men right. And they study bugs.
But like amazing music, amazing cinematography, just beautiful storytelling. And he also made another film called Barbarian Sound Studio, which was about a guy working, doing sound design for Italian kind of horror films and dealing with like the horrific nature of the films while kind of going, losing his mind.
Hear the noises he's making. You don't ever get to see what the films is.
Yeah.
That he's scoring.
Got it. So okay.
Disturbing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Peter Strickland's one of my favorite filmmakers. Shane Carruth was one of my favorite filmmakers the last few years. He made Upstream Color and Primer, which were great films. Those were kind of sci-fi-ish. I mean, Upstream Color, I don't even know. Again, I don't really quite know how to describe it.
It's about the life cycle.
Yeah, it's about the life cycle.
Yeah.
In a very strange way, but yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot of good stuff out there.
The countdown has now started. As I was saying, the countdown has now already started.
Indeed. The countdown to this year's Eternal Village event is underway. We encourage all villagers to take advantage of the special registration prices and offers available only through June 30th. Please visit theeternalvillage.org for full details.
Your attention, please.
Not a Number, a Patrick McGowan retrospective, takes place on Saturday the 23rd of June 2018. The iconic Elstree Studios is the venue for the event, where there will be special guest question and answer sessions on stage. There will be archive screenings, attractions, book signings, a props, costumes and memorabilia display from Patrick McGowan's career, and much more. Guests so far include Jane Merrow, the actress from Danger Man and The Prisoner, Vera Day, who starred with McGowan in Hell Drivers, Alvin Rakoff, who directed the TV movie The Best of Friends, Alex Cox, movie director and film expert, John Huff, who directed the Patrick McGowan film Brass Target, Tony Sloman, the film librarian from The Prisoner, and many more. Screenings include a very rare 1955 episode of The Vise called A Gift from Heaven, never released on VHS or DVD, and only screened twice to the public since the 1960s. The episode stars Patrick McGowan in one of his earliest roles. Tickets cost £20 each. All profits from the event are donated to Tŷ Gobaith Children's Hospice in North Wales. You can find out more details about the event and buy tickets from the Unmutual website at www.theunmutual.co.uk or from Coit Media's website, www.quoitmedia.co.uk. We hope to be seeing you at the event. It promises to be a one-off, very special evening. Be seeing you.
Contemporary is fantastic. But the value of a story is its longevity. Part of the reason why I think we all like The Prisoner after 50 years is because it doesn't age. So take me back to the 1970s without using any of the big names. If we looked across that decade, 70 to 79, what are some movies from that era that still to this day are either on your shelf or in your mind that you think were standout films?
Well, I mean, our last movie called Blood of the Tribbids was like a direct, because we loved like the 70s vampire films that Hammer made so much, mm-hmm. we wanted to go make one, and Jean Roland and Jess Franco were all making these like very sexual, like female vampire films where the women had tons of agency and they're beautiful and the scenery is amazing. So like that is like a whole genre that we got obsessed with.
Yes, we love all that. I mean, I'm speaking for Sophia, but probably my favorite type of film ever is basically 70s Italian giallo and horror films. So we love a lot of the like Argento and Mario Bava films. And there's this film called Torso that's a really, Sergio Martino, I believe, is the filmmaker. That's a really amazing film.
I think I bring up Lisa and the Devil at least once a week. It's a Bava film that's just like, I just can't stop thinking about it. It's so bizarre and amazing. And it took me like a couple views to like really feel like it really sunk in.
Yeah.
But
and a lot of them are dreamlike and surreal and really just, you know, full of kind of, they're not storytelling in the traditional, they're not structured in the traditional sense of storytelling. They're more about creating visual and narrative metaphor about some topic or some idea or some experience. And there's a lot of dream logic and a lot of other, you know, visual elements that are like, this is just beautiful and we're not that worried about how it fits in narratively. We're just going to structure it, you know, so that you get the visual experience of you know, this piece. So I think that's the kind of stuff we really, really are into. I don't know. would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Sophia's, yeah. I mean, I think, well, the 70s are maybe the...
That's our best decade.
The greatest era of of horror film. Maybe like 1960 to like 1985 or something is my favorite. That's a pretty big range, but there's just a lot of really beautiful stylish stuff. And people are doing stuff now that's also great, so I shouldn't, you know, dismiss that. There's still plenty of... There's been plenty of great art made every time period.
Absolutely.
There's so much to dig into in these movies, because you guys are making like a bunch of movies a year and somehow most of them are pretty great. So that's even the weirder part, you know, like I said the other day, I was like, I've seen 100 giallo films and I know there's 100 more to dig into, and it's just, there's a constant output of them, but they really allowed them to go crazy with the artistic elements, I think.
Yeah, this film that just got, they just did a restoration of it by Dario Argento called Deep Red. That's one of my favorite films ever. The whole film is kind of structured around the reveal. I don't want to say quite, you know, I don't want to reveal the twist in it, but the entire structure and the entire visual language used in the film is all related to the answer to the mystery. So it's kind of like you don't realize it till you watch the whole thing and you're like, oh, this is all, it's all been reinforcing the idea of what the solution to the sure. you know, to the mystery is. And it's just such an interesting structure, and it feels so strange when you watch it for the first time. You're like, why are all these weird things happening? Or like, why is this visual, why are these people standing there this way? So there, you know, there was a lot of that kind of stuff where there was a type of risk that is not commonly taken, especially in mainstream film at this point.
No, not at all. Not especially not in mainstream film.
Yeah.
May I throw out a couple names from that and just get your opinions? the sort of crossing of genres, the horror and science fiction classic from the late 60s, the one called Planet of the Vampires, that they say is the inspiration for Alien and so many other films.
Sure, yeah. No vampires in it, but it's a good film. We love that kind of stuff. Yeah. Like Queen of Blood and Planet of the Vampires, all that era where it was like the
Styrofoam,
you know, the space, absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
Space mystery, space horror, all that stuff we're absolutely, totally into, yeah.
Space horror is high on my list for a genre to do someday. It just takes a little bit more money.
It truly does.
A lot more, but a little bit more.
A little bit more.
Yeah.
Another one that comes to mind, and I hope I'm getting the name right, but when we talk, as you've said, the idea of beautiful visuals, sometimes almost to the detriment of the story, was the film called Diabolique. Do you recall that? I know there's
Baba Foma as well, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in a very, very long time, and I think you haven't seen it. The thing that's a little funny with us is there are films where we are insisting on waiting to see them in a movie theater.
Sure. Sure.
I know that seems a little absurd. So there's this like list of films that we just refuse to see until they're screening at like a good movie theater. And they do come around, you know, in Los Angeles. That's actually the best thing about living here is that they're amazing, amazing screenings. So they do come around. And I think the last time that played, we were out of town or something.
The thing with Bava is that he was a cinematographer first. And
right.
He continued to do the cinematography after he became a director for most of those films. And it really shows, like, his visuals are the best. Like,
oh, they're stunning. Like, that's why I still recall that film, because I really can't tell you what it's about, but there are just these set pieces and set designs and the movement of the way the camera is following people that is mesmerizing. And again, I don't really know what it's about. I know it's a beautiful woman who drives the story ahead, but what her motive is, what the plot is. In that same vein, I just recently, as short as a couple months ago, thanks to, I think, one of the streaming services, curled up and watched, and I'm curious about your opinion on this, Barbarella.
That's Michael's favorite film.
No, I don't know what to say. It's very high on my list, though. It's very high on my list.
Yeah.
I love it. It has just the like the like right sense of humor. Free and love. Like,
if you're going to boil what Free Love was, it was that movie.
I have seen Barbarella several hundred times.
Great music. Like, the score is so good.
Yeah.
Jane Fonda, love her.
the characters in it are all great. I mean, it's just like Marcel Marceau and what is it, John Law? What's the name? Philip Law, whatever. Yeah. Angel guy, he's amazing. I mean, it's just really wonderful actors.
Costumes are insanely good. Yeah.
And when you're watching it, I mean, unlike Michael, I have not seen it in the numbers of hundreds, but I know across my life I've seen it. And when I sat to watch it, and I intently watched it again a couple months ago, what struck me was, okay, if I want to be analytical, I can step back and go, yep, that's on a soundstage in Italy, somewhere outside of Rome. But then for the briefest of moments, it only takes a second to lose sight of that and just get lost in the fact that this was a brilliant artistic concept. And even though a scene where the sled goes across the supposed ice, you know that's on a floor, it doesn't matter. Because, as you say,
fully realized world building.
Right. The music and the characters and all of their dedication to it makes you fall into that world.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I grew up on Star Trek, you know, on the original series, just watching it over and over again, loving that. And so anything that has that, like, vibe of 60s, like, you know, I don't know, plastic sets or whatever, foam sets and bright colors and all that sort of those, you know, really interesting costumes, I just immediately love.
It was committed. And they tried to make a good film, and they did make a good film, because, like, you know, you don't put that much energy into the music and the costumes and everything else if you're not artistically committed to it, you know? Like you could easily make that movie and have it be a total joke, and it's kind of a joke, but it's also, like, really well done.
Yeah, it's a satire, it's a comedy, it's a sci-fi movie, it's an adventure movie. It has fun special effects. The music is great. The sound design is great. The acting is great. I mean, I know these aren't things that people typically say about Barbarella, but,
it's objectively the truth.
Meet the most beautiful creature of the future, Barbarella. Jane Fonda is Barbarella. See Barbarella do her thing with the nice angel, with the Black Queen, with the hand-to-hand Romeo. See Barbarella do her thing in the deadly dollhouse, in the palace of pleasure, in the biting birdcage, in the chamber of dreams, and in the wild excessive machine. You find adventure beyond your imagination when you get lost in space with Barbarella.
I got it.
Barbarella. From Paramount, in Technicolor.
I very thoroughly, think that it's just a a wonderfully realized film. And I actually got to see it because I have seen it hundreds of times, like I said, but I had not ever seen the theatrical cut until 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And that was that, you know, because I know the movie so well, I was like, oh, that's slightly, you know, the very, very slight changes from what, you know, the VHS or DVD versions, which are also different from one another. So it's just really, it was so fun to see we saw a midnight screening with an audience and just seeing people. I had a bunch of friends who were seeing it for the first time and their reactions to it. It was just, it was so great. It made me so happy to like watch it with people who are watching it for the first time.
And what you're saying is about the way we consume it, because you're so right that the theatrical experience, you guys have talked about films you don't want to see until you see it on the big screen. Yeah. And let's go all the way back to clickbait. The generation today that has media in front of them so often, and so often they're seeing them on the smallest of screens, right? It's almost like a circle where the shows that we love from the 60s were made with the belief that, what the hell, the kids are watching on a 13-inch screen, it's black and white in the room, they'll never see what we do. Then suddenly we have the ability to watch it on Blu-ray, massively large, and we see the dedication that nonetheless people put in. But now you have people making art like you do, and you want it to be seen on a big screen, but then we have people watching it on these 5-inch tools in their hand. And I think exactly as you described, when you give people the chance to see it in the shape and the form that the creator really designed it, I think it creates a more impressionable or a more unique experience, because that's part of the way you, correct me if I'm wrong, that's what you're seeing in your mind's eye when you're looking through that camera, is how you want to be it shown, not just what it's being filmed. True? Wrong? What do you think?
I think so, and I think there's a community aspect to it. So like, there's nothing better to me than going to a theater with some friends and watching a movie, and then if it's like an interesting movie, then talking about it for like the next hour after it's over. Like, that to me is a great night. So I think that theater experience and seeing it with a bunch of people is amazing for almost any film.
Yeah, we're extreme. I mean, we are so, so spoiled here. And it's really fascinating because I grew up, you know, in the VHS era, renting every weirdo horror movie. Basically, my friend and I just went up and down the horror aisle and we're like, well, we haven't watched this yet. It looks weird. Let's get it. And so I saw, you know, all these movies. Some were terrible, some were great, but I never thought I would really like experience them again in a meaningful way. And now a bunch of these films are being like, because there's so many people who had that same experience that I did. Mm-hmm. A bunch of these films are getting like restorations, like 4K, very expensive restorations that you would never, you know, it's not like Library of Congress, Citizen Kane type movie. So you wouldn't expect like that money would be put into these sorts of things. But I guess enough people care that they're doing it. And we get to see these amazing restorations of films that I never even thought I would hear about again, let alone like see in the original form or in a restored form, with an audience in a great theater full of people who are into the same sort of stuff that we are. And that's really, you know, it's just an amazing
treat. That's the best case.
Yeah.
Well, first seeing a movie.
Yeah. But it's an amazing treat because I see, you know, these really weird movies. Like, there's this movie kind of like a runoff of slasher films and giallo films and everything, but it's such a bizarre movie. And I thought like, okay, I saw it on VHS. Nobody's ever going to hear about this movie again. And then it just got this huge like, kind of resurgence, and they've been showing like midnight screenings of it, and people go to it and they love, you know, it's amazing that the audience, and somebody commented on this. We went, I can't remember what the movie was, but it was an actor who's been in really, you know, lots of major films. And I can't remember even what film it was, but they said, you know, here I am at this horror screening for a film that I made 30 years ago. Whereas none of the other films I made 30 years ago are even films that anybody's heard of, let alone are being screened to full houses, you know, in major cities. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was that. I can't remember. Yeah. But so there's something special about the horror audience or the genre audience where we really were loyal to.
Well, I think a lot of these movies continue to be timeless because they spend a lot of effort making an entire universe that functions for the story And so it's not like based in the real world, like a drama or something. It's based in its own rules, you know, set of rules instead of world. So I think that's why they hold up. I think that's, again, why The Prisoner holds up, because it's entirely, everything visually in it is new and weird and like a little bit off from reality. So it's like those sorts of movies where it's not like so tied to current events or tied to what's going on in real life, they last, you know? And it's like, if they're shot on film, they look great still. So I just think like that's part of the reason why we continue to hold on to them, because it's about the characters and what they went through and the world building.
Yeah. Agree.
And all these films, the experience of watching them with people is so amazing. Like that's is a really big thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Sophia, don't let Michael hear this part of it. But what he's actually experiencing is what's called nostalgia. Because when you hit a certain age, everything that was your adolescent or your youth comes back around, because what the marketers understand is now 30 years on, we've got some cash to buy this stuff again. Don't let him know that now. Just let him believe that movie came back out of some organic thing. Yeah.
Because the people making the decisions are always.
Yeah. No, what I'm amazed by is that the nostalgia, that there were enough people like me. Yeah. There were enough people like me who, because I thought, you know, my friends and I, we were like, we're the weirdo outcasts. Like, we'd go to school and nobody else, they were all like, what is wrong with you people? You know, nobody else was watching that stuff. So to know that there's so many people kind of who went through that same experience and are now the ones with money making the decisions is kind of, it's fascinating to me.
All right, so two questions for Michael. One, when you got to Los Angeles, you made a huge life-changing event, and I know it might have been motivated something by money. You shaved off your beard. Is it back, or are you still clean-shaven?
Oh, I've got a big beard right now, yeah.
Got it back, okay.
Michael, it cycles, but...
Michael was background on Legion, the FX show, like a few months ago, and the episode just aired, and I was laughing because they made him trim his beard for it, and it's like at a length that I think is kind of awkward in the show, so it's much longer than that now if you watch Legion.
Got it. Still growing out. The other is to your love of things from the 60s and the idea of classics. Have you, by any chance, seen the... Back to the idea of auteur and creativity. Have either of you seen the web series called Star Trek Continues, where the people down in Atlanta are making these meticulous recreations of what they call the fourth season of that show?
Yeah, they're doing crazy great work.
Yeah. It's done now, I guess. Right? Yeah.
I'm not sure if we saw
most of the episodes. We didn't see maybe the last one or two, but we did really like. At first, I was skeptical, of course. And the first episode, I was like, well, I don't know, really. And then it got to Lolani. There was an episode called Lolani about an Orion slave girl that they rescue, and they have to decide whether to give her back. And it was, it did everything that good Star Trek does in like an amazing, it was, you know, a new story, but it totally, totally captured the vibe of what made Star Trek great. And I was like, this is like better than... I mean, I liked it better than any Star Trek since TOS, basically.
You know, right.
It had the feel of that. And I like the actors. I think the actors do they do a great job, because it's impossible to fill those roles, right? So, I mean, they do a great job. So we really liked it very much in the end. And we ended up meeting, it's funny, because we love this episode of Lolani so much. And we ended up working with this guy who's an art, he's an art department head mostly. That's mainly his job. And it turns out, I think I looked him up because we'd done a bunch of projects with him, and I saw that he was the one who wrote that episode. And the next time I saw him, I'm like, I can't believe you wrote this episode of Star Trek Continues that is like my favorite thing in the world. And he was like, oh yeah, that was cool. Like he was very nonchalant about it, but it was neat. So, you know, we're around these are the kind of people we're around every day. And it's really cool.
It's another example of the old statement, but it's more true than any of us want to accept. It is a very small world, and we just keep moving around in these small circles. And what I want to say is we're thrilled that you and both of you and your creativity have added to the Prisoner world, because people love what you've created. And we really want to thank you for sharing all this update. We hope that you guys get so swept up in movie making that you don't even have time to think about these other things, but please stay connected so we know And we can direct everyone to both your social media, correct? To your Facebook?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Got
We're
it.
Both on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all the things. We both have websites for our work. And
perfect.
Just our names.coms.
We will make a point when this goes up to share all that with people so they can keep in touch and keep track. Otherwise, thank you both. And we wish you all the best in all the endeavors you're doing now and in the future.
Great. Thanks so much for chatting with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All villagers are encouraged to share their thoughts and contributions with the Eternal Village Cast. Please send your remarks care of info@theeternalvillage.org. Until our next program, be seeing you.